From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. It's an age-old dream, finding an earthly paradise, a refuge from the world's troubles. One of the most potent myths is Shangri-La, or what some call Shambhala.
There is a legend that far away, beyond the Himalayas, lies a secret valley hidden by a ring of snow-covered peaks. At its center is a beautiful crystal mountain. This is the gateway to the kingdom of Shambhala. Here, the people live in peace and harmony. There is no hunger or sickness. They live long and happy lives. Of course, some say Shambhala is purely an imaginary land. But others say it is a real place, and it can still be found, if only the seeker knows where and how to look.
Today, we'll go looking for Shangri-La in the company of explorers, shamans, Buddhist scholars, and writers, including Amy Tan.
There's actually a very sinister quality about Shangri-La, the idea that you should not have a lot of passion, that you should not make a fuss over anything. That Shangri-La was the idea that you live in a life of submission.
So, is Shangri-La a gilded cage or something we should all seek?
Welcome to Shangri-La.
That's a scene from the 1937 movie Lost Horizon, which is based on the novel by James Hilton. It's the moment when Robert Conway first lays eyes on Shangri-La, the lost paradise, nestled in the Himalayas. It's one of those great Hollywood scenes, fantasy brought to the big screen. But is Shangri-La just a fantasy? The story actually goes back to ancient Buddhist texts, which suggest there really was such a place. Documentary filmmaker Michael Wood wanted to find the real Shangri-La, so he and his camera crew went trekking through the mountains to places barely touched by civilization. Wood says he was inspired by James Hilton's novel.
He was a canny writer, and he felt the mood of the times in 1933. You know, the Nazis had just come to power. As one writer said, there was the smell of burning in the air. And it was also a time when Tibet was viewed as the kind of last civilization that was kind of untouched in the world, you know, a forbidden land. And I think there's no question he had that in mind, but he also had in mind a much more ancient Tibetan and Indian legend, which goes back more than 1,000 years, that there was a world beyond the Himalayas, a kind of Buddhist world of peace, untouched by history, progress, and war and destruction. And that myth became central to Tibetan Buddhism, and it still is today.
The interesting thing to me about this paradise, and I think to you from watching your film, is that it goes beyond being a place of peace. It is somehow a place of storage of all the best that's in the world, so that when we have made a mess of the world outside, there will be a source from which peace can be restored.
That's absolutely right. I mean, in the novel, just before the hero Conway leaves the secret valley of Shangri-La, the Lama says to him, "We have a dream and a vision in Shangri-La that the most beautiful things in the world are destroyed by war and lust and brutality, and they're crushed. And Shangri-La is here to preserve the wisdom that humanity will need," as he says, "when their violent passions are spent." And it's really interesting that Hilton wrote that in 1933, but when you look at the ancient Tibetan myths, in them is this idea of, in fact, a series of secret valleys that the Tibetans call Beyuls, 21 of these that are kind of hidden and will be activated in times of crisis and trouble. And in those valleys are buried or hidden or preserved the texts and treasures and wisdom of humanity that will be brought out when we need them. And when we did our journey in through that part of Tibet, on foot through the Tibetan-speaking valleys on the very edge of Nepal that were untouched by the Chinese invasion, to our amazement, we stepped into Tibetan monasteries founded more than 1,000 years ago, where the treasures and manuscripts from the monasteries that had been destroyed by the Chinese had been gathered to be preserved. And the lamas of these monasteries were very conscious of, you know, the old legends. In fact, I remember saying to one engaging old lama in his great kind of red silk jacket, a big burly man, you know, as we sat drinking yak butter tea, and I told him the story of Shangri-La, and he just grinned and said, "Oh, it still exists."
The suggestion is that mankind has forever had this sense that we're not doing it right, but out there somewhere is a group who know what we ought to be doing and can help us when we need them.
You know, having done this journey, which I must say I found very affecting, you know, going through those Tibetan lands, we live in an age of globalization and the speed of change is immense. And because of that, it's not surprising that we're drawn to this idea that, you know, somewhere the ravages of time and history have been held back and human beings, there's one place where human beings still live in harmony. Of course, when you talk to the Tibetan lamas about it today, they have a slightly different take on it, you know, because they see all of us Westerners as being obsessed with kind of material things and so on. And they say that every human being on Earth can live in Shangri-La if we could only conquer that restless need that drives us, that makes us dream of paradises in worlds other than our own.
Did you get a sense of the spiritual nature of this? You must have become immersed in Buddhist culture. Did it give you a different sense of what Shangri-La might be, or Shambhala, as it was once called?
Well, I think, to me, from a lifetime of traveling, religions are produced by cultures, and they take on the form of their cultures. You know, Islam in Iran is a completely different matter from Islam in Arabia. And when you journey 2,000 miles to the south from where we were standing that wonderful afternoon to the tropical south of India, the religion is fecund and colourful, and it's scented with jasmine and incense and ghee and coconut and perfumes, and the people wear hardly any clothes in the summer because of the dripping heat, and the gods are fantastical and many-armed and multicoloured, and there are so many of them you can never even count them. When you go up into the wilds of the Tibetan plateau, the religion is that austere shamanic kind. And the ideas of Tibetan Buddhism are very different from the religions of the plains of India. So, yes, inevitably you kind of go out there and you understand the harshness of the landscape, the harshness of life, the central meditations of Tibetan Buddhism, of course, being on death.
I want to hear about your journey, because it was not an easy journey to take.
It wasn't an easy journey. And actually, you know, making films as we do, you have all sorts of logistical questions. For example, in this one, we had to journey through Western Nepal, which is now controlled by Maoist guerrillas. And we couldn't get filming permission to go there from the Nepali government because, of course, the guerrillas are trying to bring the government down. So we went effectively disguised as trekkers, you know, with our cameras in our tent barrels. And similarly, we didn't have permission to film in China, in Tibet. So again, we went as kind of well-heeled tourists going to the sacred mountain of Kailash, filmed on small cameras without filming permission. So even that was an edgy business. But the physical hardship was walking for a week along the edge of Nepal at high altitude, you know, up to about 15,000 feet, you know, which is kind of okay if you're acclimatized. And then the long journey up via the sacred mountain of Kailash and then across to the lost city of Saparang. Even when you could stay in a hotel, they don't have any electricity or running water, and your bottles of water froze in your room at night.
There's a lovely picture in one of your moments in the film when you got to a hotel, and I watched as they piled blanket after blanket after blanket on the bed, and I realized just how cold it must have been.
Yeah, no, it was very cold. I mean, we didn't go in the summer. We were there in late November, in fact, you know, just before the snows come. So it's a dangerous, risky time to go, because if you're cut off by the snow, you really are in trouble there, you know. But what it means is you get that translucent, dazzling blue sky without a cloud to be seen. And it's freezing, but it's wonderful. You look upon this amazing, mythic landscape, you know, and hard to think of it as a paradise, perhaps. It's cold and frigid and austere, and you don't see a tree. and many hours travelling, sometimes you don't see a human being. But it is a kind of paradise.
In these photographs that you took, the movies that you took in this part of the world, I can't feel the cold, but I can look and see the austerity you talk about, but also the suggestion that you can see forever in some of these landscapes, as though there is no end to the world. And you can understand how, as you say, a myth can begin there where it feels like the world goes on beyond
knowledge. It really does. I had one of those moments when you travel on a journey like this, of real moments of revelation, where we'd gone through, you know, this long journey through Kathmandu and out to the west of Nepal and then on foot for a week at high altitude, sleeping out, and then into Tibet. And the last day was 400 miles on dirt tracks to finally get to the verge of the lost city. And in the middle of the afternoon, we came out on a ridge about 5,000 meters, looking onto the back of the Indian Himalayas. And the vista, we reckoned, could have been anything between 500 and 600 kilometers from east to west. The most extraordinary thing about it was there was the Himalayas, you know, the eternal snows. And almost it felt as if we were looking down on them from the Tibetan plateau. We were almost at their level, as it were. And there you could see the highest mountain in India, Nanda Devi, and the sacred peaks around the sources of the Ganges and the Jamuna. And I had this terrible intuition that what appears to be the eternal snows when you're standing on the other side, looking up at this incredible vista, from here seemed to be a very, very narrow strip of ice and snow and a very, very fragile environment. And in the era of global warming, I think it is, you know. So that was one feeling. I mean, the other feeling was not a human being in sight, you know. It looked as if we could have just walked over those plateaus, over the glaciers and into India, and just 150 miles away, the plains of India, and, you know, more than a billion people going about their business, the most teeming place on earth, you know. And it really was a kind of transcendental moment, I think, where, funnily enough, the myth suddenly really took on its meaning for me.
Michael Wood is host of the PBS documentary Shangri-La and the author of the companion book In Search of Myths and Heroes.
Tell me something, Gainsford. What do you think of his talk about Shangri-La? Do you believe it?
Yes. I believe it because I want to believe it. Gentlemen, I give you a toast. Here's my hope that Robert Conway will find his Shangri-La. Here's my hope that we all find our Shangri-La.
A scene from the old Frank Capra movie Lost Horizon. According to some ancient Tibetan texts, the portal to Shangri-La is hidden in a great waterfall in the Tsangpo Gorge, the world's deepest and most impenetrable canyon.
The whole landscape of the gorges, as it's evoked in these texts, is really a metaphor for the whole journey to enlightenment.
Ian Baker is an explorer and Buddhist scholar. More than 20 years ago, he first set out to find the final five-mile stretch of the Tsangpo Gorge. Its legendary waterfall had been the subject of intense speculation for centuries, in both Tibet and in the West. After the last ill-fated British expedition in 1924, the Royal Geographical Society declared the falls nothing more than a religious myth. But Baker was determined to find it. And after eight separate journeys, he finally reached the 108-foot-high waterfall in 1998. He tells the story in his book, The Heart of the World.
It's amazing terrain. It's gorgeous on the one hand. You have this very, very wet environment, so the vegetation is very dense. You've got everything from orchids to tree palms, really almost a kind of Paleolithic type of feel to the terrain, at the same time with these mountains soaring above. And then overlaid on top of that are these Tibetan texts dating back to the 8th century and describing it in really in terms of an earthly paradise. So you're traveling kind of through a metaphysical terrain at the same time as you're trying to negotiate this very, very difficult physical terrain. This area has one of the heaviest rainfalls anywhere on the planet. Because the gorge opens down in towards India and towards the Bay of Bengal, ultimately, you get these monsoon-laden clouds that follow the gorge up from the south. and then when they hit the ice wall of the Himalayas, drop all of their precipitation. And you have a roaring river, which is very, very steep, more than 50 miles an hour in terms of its descent through the gorge, and huge standing waves, more than 20 feet high in many places, and certainly makes any travel into that region by kayak or by raft very, very forbidding. When I first went to Nepal when I was 19, I went there to study Tibetan painting, and that's when I first heard about this tradition of Babel, of these places where the physical and the spiritual world are said to overlap. And I went there and continued to go back every year over a period of 8 different journeys. Probably the most difficult journey of them all was the first one, where we actually tried to make this sort of direct assault, if you will, on this unexplored section of the gorge. And we reached a point really no farther than the Frank Kingdon Ward, the explorer who had reached the same point in 1924. At that point, we'd had almost 14 days of nonstop rain, and we were forced to try to climb out of the gorge because ahead of us was, again, the same sheer cliffs that had confronted Ward. But there were mists and rain. We had no map for that particular area, and we were forced to cross over a spur of this 25,000-foot peak, a snow-covered pass, and ended up in a cirque, a glacial cirque, trying to find our way down through an incredibly difficult terrain, ravines, jungles, eventually hitting a river that we had to spend almost 2 days trying to get a bridge across. We ran out of food. It was a time when you really, really felt that we were on the edge, and that a few more days like that, we would have starved. And we were eventually stumbled upon by two hunters dressed in animal skins. Texts describe this whole region as the body of a tantric goddess, and symbolically the pilgrim travels through the body of this goddess as they journey down the Tsangpo River into the different sort of chakras, or as they're referred to as the energy centers of the goddess, until you emerge at her heart, where this mystical paradise is said to lie. The largest waterfall in the center of three was described as the portal into this innermost realm, into this place where one attains immortality of a sort. The river pours through a narrow 50-foot slot, pouring over a ledge to about 108 feet high, this being the falls of the Tsangpo that had been the grail, you could say, of so many Western explorers from the second decade of the 19th century. It was an incredible sight, and at the same time, this is the portal, this is the doorway into this hidden land. An extraordinary spot. Yeah. And in the Tibetan world, of course, they believe there would be a passageway through the falls, but with the tremendous force of water, there was no way even really to dispel that particular belief. But there was a passageway, a tunnel, leading into the rock wall directly across from the falls on the opposite wall, but no way to reach it. Deeply believe that the journey itself is a kind of a meditation, an opportunity to look at the mind, to look at our responses to the world around us, and to, in a certain sense, reform them. And in so doing, we create our own destination. And that, to me, really is what the whole idea of Shangri-La is about. You know, when James Hilton's novel first appeared in 1933, it was a period not entirely dissimilar to what we're facing in the world now, a period of great political uncertainty, when the whole foundations of Western civilization are being kind of reevaluated. I think that certainly my own journey was really about how, you know, we can spend our lives looking for for the paradise on earth, but ultimately it's really up to us to create it in the same way that Shangri-La was something that was created.
Ian Baker's book is called The Heart of the World, A Journey to the Last Secret Place. Coming up, more on Shangri-La from novelists Amy Tan and Salman Rushdie.
I have not come to speak of the fall of man, but the collapse of paradise itself. In Kashmir, it is paradise itself that is falling. Heaven on earth is being transformed into a living hell.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Over the years, Amy Tan has created a unique fictional landscape where Asia meets America. Her best-selling novels The Joy Luck Club and The Bonesetter's Daughter delve into this cultural divide and the comic misunderstandings that crop up between Chinese and Americans. In her new novel Saving Fish from Drowning, Tan follows a group of American tourists who travel to China and Burma. As Steve Paulson discovered, it's a comic novel that takes on some serious issues, like political repression in Burma. But Tan also has plenty of fun with her American tourists, looking for enlightenment in China.
Miss Rong enjoyed the opportunity to inform her charges of Buddhist ideas. She had heard that many Americans, especially those who traveled to China, love Buddhism. She did not realize that the Buddhism the Americans before her loved was Zen-like, a form of not thinking, not moving, not eating, anything living, like buffaloes. This blank-minded Buddhism was practiced by well-to-do people in San Francisco and Marin County, who bought organic buckwheat pillows for sitting on the floor, who paid experts to teach them to empty their minds of the noise of life. This was quite different from the buffalo torture and bad karma Buddhism found in China. Miss Rong also did not realize that most Americans, especially those with pets, have great sympathy for animals in misery, often more so than for miserable humans.
Now, Burma, in your book, becomes the land of illusions, and partly this is a reference to Buddhism. But tell me what you mean by illusions.
There's an illusion that has to do with a tourist notion, I think, of going into a country with certain mysteries, the Shangri-La view of an exotic country like China, parts of China at least, and Burma, and that you will see, you know, in part the past that you romanticize. There's also the illusion of seeing only the surface of what's going on in a country, and of course not being aware of its history, its politics, or what is really happening in the lives of people who are before you. You see mostly the beauty of monuments and structures and the landscape. And so for me, so much of it in going, I actually went to Burma, and I had that sense, you know, that what I was seeing was completely all the beauty. And you can go to Burma and see only that.
Well, what happens in your story then is this group of American tourists that you write about, they end up being essentially kidnapped by a tribe in Burma, the Karen. Then they end up going off into this very remote little spot in the jungle. Well, it's interesting because you referred earlier to Shangri-La and this notion that Americans have of wanting to discover this unspoiled place that hasn't been touched by Western civilization. And to some degree, the Americans think that they have come across this Shangri-La. But in other ways, there's all kinds of misery there as well.
Yeah. I think the Shangri-Las we often think about are those with a lot of somehow peace. We're going to find some deeper meaning in life because it takes us far away from the noise of life, and there we are. We have peace within ourselves. We are not fettered by demands. And there's actually a very sinister quality about Shangri-La that I think James Hilton in the original Shangri-La and Horizons alluded to, and that was the idea that you should not have a lot of passion, that you should let things be, you should not make a fuss over anything. It really, that Shangri-La was the idea that you live in a life of submission. It's a life of repression. It's the mindset of the masses that dictators have found very useful. And that is also the kind of Shangri-La that I wanted to capture in this book. You know, the beautiful one, the illusion, the elusive one that we're all seeking, and then this very real one in which passions are not allowed to exist.
Now, I don't want to give away the ending of the story, but there is a scene near the end that I'd love to have you describe when the Americans who've been drawn away and end up staying with this small group of Karen tribespeople, they are caught up in a frenzy of drumming and chanting, and they seem to be transported, at least for a short time, into another dimension. I'm wondering if you could read that passage.
The chanting grew louder, and the drums, horns, gourds, and flutes fell into the rhythm of an excited heart. Boom-tuck, boom-tuck. Faster and faster, louder and louder. The repetitious din made it hard to think or move. The pounding and chanting had become a communal heartbeat. With a single last bang of the bronze drum, all the souls in No Name Place were jolted out of their bodies, my friend's souls too. Were they dead? Had they been shot? They did not feel wounded. They felt bigger and lighter. They seemed to see themselves, not their physical bodies, but their own thoughts and truths, as if there were a mind mirror that could reflect such things. They all had those mirrors. Now that they were outside of their bodies, they could hear without the distortions of ears, speak without the tangle of tongues, see without the blinders of experience. They were open portals to many minds, and the minds flew into the soul, and the soul was contained in the minds of everyone. They knew this was not normal, and yet it was natural. They struggled for words to describe what they felt, that they were every thought they had ever had, and those of others, an open repository containing bright particles and endless strands, microscopic stars and infinite trajectories, endless constellations that were holograms within holograms within themselves, the invisible as visible, the impossible as obvious, the greatest knowledge now effortlessly known, and the greatest knowledge was love, just love.
Oh, that's such a wonderful scene. And it, in some ways, this is the other side of what we've been talking about. We've been talking about how there's often this confusion as we cross cultures, but maybe there are these moments when it all comes together, when people are on the same plane.
Yes, I was trying to imagine what the absolute point would be in my imagination when all these differences in beliefs and experiences and situations could possibly merge and where people could understand each other completely.
Did that just come out of your imagination, that scene, or is it based on anything in particular?
In part, it did come from imagination, you know, the sense of many different people and the musical instruments that help in some way become that universal language. But I also had an experience like that, and it was such a powerful, the most powerful experience that I have ever had. And I look back on it, and sometimes I think that perhaps it was a delusion, you know, a hallucination or even a seizure. But a great deal of my heart would like to believe that it was true.
Wow, we're leaving the best for the last. Can you briefly describe what happened in that experience?
it was 24 hours after my mother had died, and I was grieving a little bit more than I thought I would have because I prepared for it for such a long time, wrote all these books about her, and all of a sudden I saw a hologram, a huge hologram, and it was my mother, a hologram within a hologram, and it moved toward me, and I thought, oh, I am hallucinating, and when it got to the point where a real person would have touched me, I was suddenly shocked and filled with this feeling as though I now understood completely her feelings and she understood mine and I needed no words. And this feeling was the most supersaturated sense of love, and that love was both peace and hope. I literally gasped. I went like that. And I have no idea how long it lasted, except that my husband came into the room. My dog had left me and gone barking, which he never does, and to lead my husband back up. And he walked in, and he saw me staring, and I said, "You'll never believe what just happened to me." I was so glad he came in the room, you know, to prove to me I wasn't asleep when that happened. I was making enough sense that I could tell him what I was seeing, what I had just felt.
Amy Tan talked with Steve Paulson. Her latest novel is called Saving Fish from Drowning. Kathleen Matthews is a Celtic scholar and storyteller who's fascinated by myths of lost paradise. She says there's a good reason these stories exist in every culture. They reflect our deepest yearnings. And Kathleen Matthews thinks we can actually enter paradise, if we're willing to make the journey.
Why do you think the myth of a lost paradise is, I guess, such a potent and such a pervasive story in so many different cultures?
Well, I think certainly in the West that for us, one of the underlying stories that really hits sort of the major three traditions is the fall from grace, as it is called, or the casting out from the Garden of Eden. And of course, because of the history of Christianity in the West, it has another little sort of turn in the tale, because it tells us that once everything was perfect and that we, humanity, made it so that it was no longer perfect and that we were cast out as a result of that. So there's this sense of sin and guilt and so on, which is all wound up with this story. And so the sense of wanting to return to paradise is wanting to return to the sense of wonder and of joy and of wholeness which we've lost.
The Garden of Eden story is such a problematic one for us, as you point out, because it involves sin and guilt and the feeling that we humans did something terribly wrong to have been booted out of paradise. Are there other stories of lost paradises that don't have such a heavy overlay of sin and guilt?
Well, I think there are sort of hidden and woven within our traditions. We have quite a few. I suppose one of the most potent stories that we have in the West is the Grail story. There are very many different versions, but the roots of that lie back in the sort of the Celtic other world. And in the other world, there are these cauldrons and other vessels or fountains that bring healing and grace and harmony back to the world.
I guess that gets us to the question of what this paradise is that we tell so many stories about. I mean, it's more than a place. It's an inner state, a way of existing in the world.
Yeah, it seems to be a dimension that we carry within us and which is not lost. For example, I have a shamanic practice here in Oxford, and when I'm teaching people to journey, to actually enter into the other world, one of the first things that people find is that place of paradise. And nearly every first journey, every first entry into that other world that people take is accompanied by tears of recognition and joy. So I find that very interesting, that the places that we think we've lost, we haven't lost, that they are inner states of completion and wholeness, and that what we are suffering from within our everyday world is a state of duality, that we are fallen out of wholeness with the rest of the universe, that we're somehow separate from it.
Tell me a bit more about your shamanic practice. I mean, how do you help people find this other world inside themselves, the paradise that they've dreamed of?
Well, I do two things in my practice, one of which is to see people whose story is fractured or broken. So very similar, I suppose, to our story of Eden, that there's a relationship that people have been locked out of. There's been some disruption of things that have not been able to be cleared or healed by medical science or by psychology. So what I'm looking at is bringing things back into a state of spiritual wholeness again. So that's sort of one part of my work. And that's accomplished by journeying into the other world and meeting the inhabitants there, the spirits of the other world.
But tell me more about that, because that's such an alien idea to most people, the idea that you can journey to another world.
Well, what do we do when we pray and when we meditate? And of course, we're very used to entering our dreams. What are we doing when we're dreaming? Some dreams are, of course, digestive dreams of the day that's just gone round, little chewings up of the day. But sometimes we have those big dreams, those dreams where we're full of wonder, dreams when we fly, dreams when we encounter people who are no longer with us in this world, for example, loved relatives or pets. So we're working outside of time when we enter into the other world. And I think everyone is at least used to their dreaming. What is happening is our soul is leaving our body, or part of our soul is leaving our body and actually journeying into another dimension. It's not a place and it's not bounded by time. And when people journey, it's a very similar experience, except that, of course, it's under more controlled circumstances and usually with a quest in mind, a question that you're pondering upon so that the journey responds to that.
Do you remember your first journey and where did you go?
My first journey, in a formal sense, because I think I've always, every time I sing, that's what happens. I am transported on sound into another place. But formally, actually doing it with a real conscious sense, I was taken to the most beautiful primordial tree, the tree of trees, that's the only way I can describe it, a tree of chiming, a tree of singing. And under it sat the guardian of the wild world, someone who is partially human, partially animal, but someone who had great compassion. And just being in the presence of that tree, in the presence of that beautiful landscape, in the presence of that being who accepted me as I was, who didn't look at me and sort of think, oh, she's not perfect yet. No, we don't want her here. There was none of that. It was a sense of being welcomed and of belonging.
I wonder also about the role of the feminine in all of these myths of Paradise Lost. I mean, certainly in the Garden of Eden story, it's the interpretation for many years has been it was all Eve's fault. But another lost paradise myth that has become very popular with feminists in more recent years is the story of Avalon, the lost island of the women adepts, the women sorceresses.
Well, that's one way, but I don't think we've ever lost Avalon. As someone who lives in Britain, I would say I don't think we ever lost Avalon. Well, you know, you would only have to walk down any street here in Oxford and ask someone where King Arthur was, and they say, well, he's ready to come back any time we need him. You know, he is not dead. Long live the king, he is not dead. He will come again. Everyone knows that here.
Well, that suggests the kingdom of paradise is just there waiting for you, and it'll emerge any day.
But, you know, Avalon is a realm of apples again. It's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, the fruit in the Bible isn't specified as being an apple, but of course, traditionally, it has become so in iconography and so on. But the realm of Avalon is the realm of apples, and it's guarded by nine women who are otherworldly women. And this is part of a very long Celtic tradition of the other world. You know, the sort of the deeper understanding of this is that, you know, the divine feminine has many different faces, but the faces that it takes within the realm of Avalon are of like nine muses who have different functions, who can heal, who can create, who can generate, who can do very many different things, raise winds, shapeshift, and that people visit these places in order to find these skills and gifts. And I feel that this story is very much about the way we ourselves weave between the worlds. Very many stories talk about, for example, about a man lying on his bed and suddenly in his sleep an otherworldly woman comes to him and she shakes a silver branch at him. And the silver branch is a sort of like a branch that's come from the otherworldly tree, and it plays the musical bells over him. And he passes into a state that is beyond tears, that is beyond sleep, that is beyond laughter, although it has all those three gifts too.
That's beautiful.
And says, come, come, arise, you know, come into the land of women, find what is waiting for you.
Kathleen, for people who are not perhaps ready to begin shamanic journeying on their own, and who yet have, who resonate when you talk about that hunger, that longing, is there anything else that people can do to begin to get back a sense of that paradise that's lost?
Well, I think that a very laudable way of doing this, and a way that everyone can do, is to honour the land that they live in and those who live on and around it. I can think of no better way to honour paradise than to actually recognise that it's not just an inner state. And we all have a very deep longing and love of the countryside. I mean, the land itself is everything that is holy. There is no holier place than the earth. All that is made is holy. If we live with that in our minds and our hearts, then we find the proper respect with which we treat the land, we treat animal, plant, and human life with that respect, as though we were all inhabitants of paradise.
Kathleen Matthews is a Celtic scholar and folklorist in Oxford, England. Her books include Singing the Soul Back Home, Sophia, Goddess of Wisdom, and Celtic Book of the Dead. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Do you have visions of paradise yourself? Is Shangri-La just a myth? If you'd like to share your thoughts, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, Salman Rushdie on Shangri-La, Kashmir, and the political novel. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, I've got to say I was surprised to hear about the title character in Salman Rushdie's new novel, Shalimar the Clown. He's not only a Muslim fanatic, but a political assassin. Let's just say I remember all too clearly what happened the last time Rushdie ran afoul of Islamic ideologues. But Rushdie's novel's not just a story about Islamic fanaticism. It's also about Kashmir, which Rushdie says was once a kind of earthly paradise. This may be hard to believe today, given the devastation caused by the recent earthquake in Pakistan and the political violence that's ravaged the region for decades, but Rushdie told Steve Paulson that Kashmir was once a magical place. Here's an excerpt from his novel.
We who live in these luxury limbos, the privileged purgatories of the earth, have set aside thoughts of paradise, yet I tell you that I have seen it and walked by its fish-rich lakes. In Kashmir, it is paradise itself that is falling. Heaven on earth is being transformed into a living hell.
That passage is so interesting because for most of us in the West, Kashmir is anything but paradise. It seems to be a prime example of a region that's been torn apart by religious and ethnic hatred. And yet, part of what you've done in this novel is to take us back to a time when Kashmir was much more peaceful. In fact, when it was almost a kind of Shangri-La.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, a part of Kashmir, one of the high valleys of Kashmir, Ladakh, was probably the model for Shangri-La in James Hilton's novel Lost Horizon a long time ago. But certainly for me and for many people in India, for a long time, in living memory, until about 20 or 30 years ago, Kashmir was this enchanted place. It was India's holiday playground. It's where people went from all over India in the hot season to go and enjoy snow and coolness. But apart from its kind of tourist values and apart from its enormous physical beauty, there was also a kind of what one might call human beauty. There was a culture that had grown up in Kashmir of harmony, broadly speaking, harmony between different religions, between primarily Hindus and Muslims, but also Sikhs and a very few Christians and Jews.
Now, I've read that you were very fond of your grandfather, who I believe lived in Kashmir, who was a devout Muslim.
Yes, he was my mother's father. He and my grandmother both were raised in Kashmir and met and married there. Subsequently, he came south out of Kashmir and practiced medicine elsewhere in India. But yeah, he was the kind of giant of my childhood and a very gentle, tolerant, open-minded, big-hearted man. One might say, in spite of the fact that he, unlike me, was a very devout Muslim and had performed the pilgrimage to Mecca and said his prayers 5 times a day and was teased by his grandchildren for his excessive devotion, as we would. And yet he was absolutely open to all kinds of discussion. There were no no-go areas. It was nothing like the radical, fanatical Islam that we hear so much about now. And he became, for me, a kind of model of how to be in the world.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you say that because, of course, your public persona is someone who is very critical of at least a certain kind of Islam, radical Islam, and yet you're saying you were very influenced by this devout Muslim who happened to be your grandfather.
You know, I'm not myself religious, but it doesn't stop me being influenced by good people when I have the good fortune to be around them, especially if they're my grandfather. And I think, you know, one of the things that the book tells is that the kind of Islam that existed in Kashmir was of this kind. It was of my grandfather's kind. It was devout, yes, but it was also very lightly worn. You know, it wasn't something that people beat their fists on tables about. It wasn't menacing or threatening. It was mild, mystical, and lived in harmony with people of other religions. And that Islam was attacked from across the Pakistan border by radical jihadist groups coming in there with a quite different idea of Islam.
But what's astonishing about the story is that this all happened within about a generation or so. I mean, you're really saying that when you were growing up, Kashmir was a peaceful region, and now it's so torn apart by violence.
I mean, as recently as, I would say, even the late 1970s, the world I'm describing still substantially existed. And now, I mean, the real explosion took place in 1989. And since then, it's been, one of the world's great trouble spots. You know, Kashmiris are so famous, legendarily gentle and non-violent in India that there are jokes about it. You know, in the way that people make Polish jokes or rude jokes about communities, the rude jokes about Kashmiris were all about their lack of martial spirit and their lack of courage. So lacking in violence was the valley. It's deeply ironic that of all places, this place, which was so famous for its peacefulness, should now be so famous for its violence. The thing that happened did not happen from inside the Kashmiri people. It happened from outside. First, they were seriously oppressed by the presence of gigantic numbers of Indian soldiers who were there in order to hold the valley against what they perceived as the risk of Kashmiri, of Pakistani attack. And then they were attacked by the Pakistani-sponsored Islamic radicals. So they were caught between the rock of India and the hard place of Pakistan.
So you're saying this is not just because of the hardliners from Pakistan, that India has its share of responsibility in all of this.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why one of the epigraphs to the novel is "A Plague on Both Your Houses" from Romeo and Juliet is that that's exactly what happened in Kashmir. It got squeezed between two warring powers. And what nobody ever asked the people of Kashmir is, what do they want? And they've rather consistently said that what they wanted was to be left alone.
Is that still possible?
Well, the only thing to be said is that there are beginning to be more peace-like noises from both India and Pakistan. There are beginning to be conversations between the governments, and there's a rhetoric of peace. It has begun to be heard.
I've heard that actually one of the hopeful signs have been the cricket matches that Pakistan and India have played against each other.
Yeah, it's rather wonderful, actually, because it used to be that when India and Pakistan played each other at cricket, the cricket ground would become like a kind of war zone. You know, there would be so much security there in order to prevent the explosion of some kind of Indo-Pakistan violence. Now it's the opposite. Now when they have these cricket matches, they're like love-ins. You know, the people, the supporters of the two teams meet as if they were one people, which, of course, until 60 years ago, they used to be. And they each celebrate the achievements of the other team. I mean, it is kind of ludicrously nice. One could argue that cricket may be the way that India and Pakistan will finally make peace.
Now, I read one review of your book which said that the overarching theme of many of your recent novels has been a kind of quarrel with history, that you've been arguing with how history has turned out, and perhaps you yourself feel trapped by history. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, it's an interesting one. Yeah, I mean, I didn't read that review, but it sounds interesting to me. I mean, you know, the thing is that I didn't study English literature at university. I studied history. And so for me, that engagement with history has always been an important part of how I've approached writing.
So you're saying in your fiction, you feel obligated to write about politics. You cannot just deal with a sort of a private, personal world.
Yeah, I mean, that's when you say politics, what I don't mean is that the books have a simple polemic purpose. You know, they're not trying to make a point. I mean, Uncle Tom's Cabin, that's a political novel. It's trying to make the point that slavery is bad, and indeed was a very powerful political novel. My interest is more to try and show the way in which ordinary lives are also shaped by the great events of our time. So Shalimar the Clown, for example, the character, one of the great shaping events in his life is an entirely private event, or seemingly private, which is that his wife breaks his heart by leaving him and running off with the American ambassador, a man who he subsequently, many years later, will get his revenge on by murdering. Now, that seems like a perfectly private, if you like, a story of a crime of passion, a revenge tragedy. But as you read the book, you see that those private lives are set into the public context of tension between East and West, of what we've been discussing, of the growth of Islamic radicalism. And this is a function that literature has always performed, but I think it might be unusually important right now.
But in some ways, it didn't seem to perform that role when, well, let's say when Jane Austen was writing, even though she was writing in the heyday of the British Empire, and certainly British soldiers popped up in her stories, but she didn't get at the larger political issues.
No, she didn't. I mean, there are people who have criticized Jane Austen for that, but in my view, that's getting the wrong end of the stick. The point about the 18th century, and indeed some of the 19th century, is that it was entirely possible for Jane Austen to tell the story of her characters without involving the public sphere, because the public life did not impact on the lives of her characters. There's nothing that happens to the Bennet sisters in Pride and Prejudice that would have been improved by bringing in the Napoleonic Wars, you know, because those wars are remote from them in the place where they live, and their story can be fully told without an appeal to history. And I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, even more recently than Jane Austen, you know, Charles Dickens, arguably the greatest ever English novelist, wrote this huge shelf of novels and barely ever mentioned the British Empire, which was in those days at its height and controlling a quarter of the world. It didn't seem necessary to him to tell the stories of his people, to make reference to that. In the time between Charles Dickens and now, the world has dramatically changed, and I think that the public and the private have just got pushed much, much closer together, partly by the intervention of things like radio and television, and now, of course, the internet. We all know about each other in milliseconds, but also because, you know, owing to all kinds of different things like, you know, mass migration or globalization, and yes, you know, even things like international terrorism, the world has become a much smaller place. And I think, you know, as a novelist, I have to take cognizance of that.
Salman Rushdie. His latest novel is called Shalimar the Clown. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a CD of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show called Searching for Shangri-La, number 116B. If you have comments about the show, you can send them to us through our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Anne Strainchimps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.